Good evening. I'm glad Jerry is good.
We can never stop.
We are obviously reconvening after a little bit of a break. I had to make half soccer between the books, so we finished Megillat Esther, and there's still plenty to talk about that. And we're learning Sefer Daniel. I've got to say Shechianu, because it's the first time I've ever delved into the book of Daniel. There's something very strange about the book of Daniel. It's the most famous and yet the most mysterious book probably in the whole of Tanakh. Famous, all the stories are famous, right? The lion's den and the writing on the wall and everything that we know. That's the first half of the book. The second half of the book, as you're going to see, is full of nevuah, prophecy. And it's going to be not just challenging, it's going to be almost impossible to understand what he's really saying. And what I wanted to show you, as by way of introduction, before we even get into discussion about who he was and what the world was like that he was in, I just want to show you here. This is taken from a sefer which is came out in Israel a few years ago by somebody called Yigal Ariel, who is a teacher in one of the yeshivot in the north of Israel. And I just want to show you a little bit of what he writes in. It's on the left hand side, halfway down, where you see the English word scared, S-C-A-R-E-D. And I'll just tell you what he says here, the attitude towards learning the book of Daniel. Okay? We're jumping into the lion's den. This is what we're doing. Listen to this. Rabim nirta'im milumod et sefer Daniel. There are many who are very, nirta means, you know, almost petrified to learn the book of Daniel. I said scared, but it's probably stronger than that. Umit almim mimenu, and miss it out completely. And this is talking about people who learn Tanakh, you know, in an organized fashion. Hasefer hushmat miseda limud. This sefer is missed out from the order of learning. Hein liyachid, hein letzibur, for individuals or for the communities. Ve'eino nimtza b'tochniyot alimud shebotei sefer yeshivot. And, you know, if you've got yeshivot that do learn Tanakh, the few that do exist, it's not there. Even in the high schools in Israel, which obviously learn Kasedo through the Tanakh, the Book of Daniel is not quite their first choice. So some people argue, you know why? Because the half the book, as we'll see, is going to be in Aramaic, and it's not easy to learn. All right. Avala tirutz kalush, but he said this is a very shvacha teretz. It's a very weak answer. Shere kvar kayamim perushim miluliyim. He says that you'll see Rashi translates word by word, and we're going to have, you know, sort of other translations. So you've got a translation. It's a big deal. So you're going to read the Aramaic and you translate it. That's not a good excuse. Ulai, he says, maybe amimut dargat nevuatol shel Daniel hechlishat ratzon. In other words, what Daniel is prophesying is very, very difficult. And it becomes very frightening, as you'll see some of the things he's going to say. Ela shemul elu haroim b'chazono divrei ruach ha-kodesh ha-metzuafim b'astarot merubot. At the end of the day, what is Daniel all about? There are many, many visions that he has through ruach ha-kodesh, right, in which he sees many hidden mysteries. Some people say that, you know, it may be some sort of visions. We're not quite sure where it's coming from. Other people argue that this is the greatest nevuah, some of the greatest nevuah, some of the greatest prophecies in the Bible, which are very clearly pronounced in the Bible. So, Nireh, we'll have to suggest, why people have kept away from the book, he tachnav hamutzpanim v'kishalon chishuvei haketz. And this is very, very interesting. The end of the book of Daniel is incredibly powerful in terms of messianic analysis, predictions, and whatever. And I have to tell a little story, because there's a story that goes with this, which he doesn't bring, but it's a story about the Malbim. The Malbim, the very famous commentary written by the rabbi who was the chief rabbi of Bucharest and had many, many positions. He usually was thrown out of his job because he couldn't hold back his comments. He was a very interesting character. I mean, once upon a time, there's just a story to give you a flavor of what he was like. He met two Jews on Yom Tov, and they were smoking a cigarette on Yom Tov. I mentioned the story to Abe. And they're walking in the street, and they said hello to the rabbi. And the rabbi sort of, I've got to get this story the right way around. Yeah, I think it was on Yom Tov. And the rabbi looked at them and said to them, almost to the point of ignoring them. So they wanted to know, why was the rabbi ignoring them? So he said, I didn't recognize you. So they said, why? So they said, because normally when I see you smoking cigarette, it's normally on Shabbos and it's not on Yom Tov. That's what he said to them. I mean, you know, he didn't mince his words. Pow, you know, in the face. And this is the sort of comment that he would make. You can see why he became a bit unpopular in his situation. It's a story on those lines. I'm not quite sure I've got the story right, but it's the same type of thing. He was very charif. He was very, very, very severe. So what happened was...
He was very sweet, too, because
yeah.
I have no money, I have nothing. So he asked her, what can you do that's good?
Yeah.
And she says, well, I make great blintzes.
Yeah.
So he put her in the blintzes business, and she became a big
success. And she became a big success, yeah. Wow. There's clearly two sides, you know, there's many sides to this character. He's, what I do know from the sort of the English, the Anglo-Jewry point of view, is that he was on the shortlist to become Chief Rabbi of England. All the people that I've heard of to become Chief Rabbi of England in those days never got the job. The one who did get the job, nobody ever heard of, and probably nobody ever heard of since. Although his father was very famous, a guy called Herman Adler, who was the son of a very, very the Rebbe of the Chassam Sofer. So, you know, there was a connection there. But the Malbim was shortlisted, but for reasons that I guess they felt they couldn't take him, because, you know, who knows what he's going to say, who knows what he's going to do. But he was very, very significant, and his commentary, part of the books that he wrote. His commentaries were on Sefer Daniel. And what he did in Sefer Daniel, which really is quite amazing, is that when, at the end, as please God will get there eventually, we'll see that there are ramazim, there are hints to the date of the Mashiach. What the Malbim did is that he actually started using this as a way of trying to put a date, you know, the whatever month or whatever year, according to this particular book. And he was criticized for it. The Olam said, we don't do this. All right, you know, messianic prediction is something that we don't do. The reality was that a lot of people didn't realize that it was done. It was done right through the Middle Ages, and it's usually done at the time of crisis. When the Jewish people were suffering, like in the Crusades, many of them used the astrological predictions to try and determine when the Mashiach is coming, to end those terrible sufferings. And in the days of the Malbim, I guess 19th century was tremendous upheaval, certainly in the Jewish community, the Haskalah and everything that was going on. And no question that, you know, there was a school of thought to say, you know, let's look into this, let's try and be brave and maybe suggest a date. And apparently his books were banned because of this, almost to the point, not quite banned, but, you know, they became unpopular but in certain circles. And it's crazy because his commentary on Torah, Nevi'im Ketuvim, is so phenomenal. And his mastery of the Hebrew language was so incredible that without the Malbim's commentary, you know, you're missing out a whole parshanut, a whole idea, a whole approach to Torah. It's an incredible thing. So the reality of it is, and this is what Rav Ariel is saying here, that every time a book like the Book of Daniel was thought about in the yeshivot or whatever, they wouldn't want to touch it. There is a tradition that because he deals with Chishuvei HaKetz, as he says over here, thinking about the end of days and trying to work out when it's going to be, this is a problem. Because what happens if you predict a date and it doesn't come up? It doesn't happen. Right? You say it's going to be next Tuesday afternoon and it doesn't happen. So he says over here, the final line of that paragraph, Goramuli Yush Mina Efsharud La'amodah Sodo. People would give up hope. If somebody had predicted a certain date and it didn't happen, then, you know, what are we going to do? And this is something which has always been a problem about Sefer Daniel. So, As much as the stories are famous, the first half of the Sefer, which a lot of it you will recognize in terms of, as I say, you know, the three friends of Daniel and all the various famous things that is mentioned there, the end of the book from chapter 7 through to chapter 12 is going to be very big revelation, and I'm still working out in my own mind how we're actually going to deal with it when we get there, but it won't be for a period of time. Sorry?
You'll give us a timeline.
And I have to give you a timeline. Very good. What we'll do today, again, just a little bit of intro before we read chapter 1, is to talk a little about the time period, what we're doing. If we put Megillat Esther as a kind of marker in Jewish history, what we're doing in the book of Daniel is we're going back. We're actually going back. Remember that timeline I gave you, when we spoke about King Cyrus, Koresh, and he allows the Jews to go back to Eretz Israel to rebuild the Beit HaMikdash. That gentleman, Koresh, is someone who is around at the end of the life of Daniel. It says, in fact, at the end of chapter 1, that Daniel lived till the first year of King Cyrus. So basically, what Daniel represents, which is so interesting, is that he is a gentleman who actually goes into the Golah. He's exiled with the Jews. Not at the Churban HaBayit, but a few years beforehand. There were various stages of exile. And he stayed out of Eretz Israel his whole life. He dreamed of Eretz Israel. He was the Zionist who lived in Babylon. You'll see eventually he gets to Shushan, various other places. And his whole dream, his whole chalom, his whole future, he hoped, would be to return to Eretz Israel. And there's a lot of suggestion that his influence on, not only, and it's amazing, he even influences Nebuchadnezzar, this famous king, who came to destroy the temple eventually. And as we know, there's a famous story what happened afterwards. He is influenced by Daniel as much as the other kings that came after him, Darius and various other kings. And Daniel is like a link. He's a link in the chain between the end of the first Commonwealth of Israel with the Churban HaBayit and the beginning of the second Commonwealth. It's like Daniel fills the gap, and this is a very special man. He's a big question which is raised: why, if it's prophecy, why isn't the book in Sefer Nevi'im? Why isn't it one of the books of prophetic books that we have? Why do we have it? Because this is essentially a Sefer Ketuvim. This is the writings. This is supposed to be on a lower level. So again, the answer is given. The Barbanel says, he says that, look, Daniel was not a prophet for the people. He was a prophet who had visions that he wrote down. And the tradition is, it wasn't written down by him. It was written down by the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah in Eretz Yisrael. They would write the book in Israel, even though the visions happened in Babylon. It happened outside Israel. Right, which is again very fascinating. The whole history is interesting. And what the visions were not necessarily Daniel going to the people like Isaiah and Jeremiah would say to the people, do tshuva, you know, and become better Jews and whatever. He didn't do any of that. He was in the palace of the kings of initially Nebuchadnezzar, and then afterwards he sort of jumped, went from king to king, and he was there, and he never really was a figurehead for the people around him. I guess they knew about him. They knew who he was. And it's interesting because what we're going to see in the story is obviously a very big parallel to Yosef. Yosef in Mitzrayim, what does Yosef do? He's involved with the king, with Paro, with Chalamot, with dreams and everything. And we're going to see already at the beginning, Daniel is involved with Nebuchadnezzar. He gets right into the highest level of the king, the palace of the king. He's in the court of the king. And as we'll see already from the beginning, from chapter 2 onwards, he's involved with Nebuchadnezzar in a very direct way. So what I'm trying to paint a picture here is, firstly, of the time period. As I said, we've moved back from Megillat Esther to a previous time period. The time period which essentially is reflected in the exile of the Jewish people from Israel, the 70 years and beyond. And also we're dealing with an individual who's not the Navi going out to the people, but he is the kind of closeted Navi. He's the Navi who is basically going to have these visions, and he's going to have these incredible revelations, and he's going to exhibit, in the most difficult of circumstances, a tremendous emunah b'Hashem. All right. One of the themes, as we'll see here, again, this piece of paper we'll probably refer back to, he talks about the idea, one of the themes of the Sefer is Kiddush Hashem. Daniel is very concerned with maintaining the respect, the dignity of the God of Israel, even in the most foreign and distant place that you could ever find yourself. No question that where he finds himself here is in a very, very, what we used to call in the Haim, they used to call it the Treif in the Medina. This is about as treif as it gets. And it's really fascinating, absolutely fascinating, as you'll see when we get stuck into the text a little bit. Yeah.
Just to be clear, Korban Abayis happens before Daniel is...
No, he's already exiled before Korban Abayis. What happened? Nebuchadnezzar comes to Israel with Jehoiachin.
So it's 9 years before.
It's about eight or nine years before. And he doesn't seem to comment on it. All right, as far as I remember reading, but it's clearly part of the picture. It's already considered destroyed. The Commonwealth is already gone. Because what happens is that after Yoshio dies, King Josiah, he's got sons who take over, but then it's not going to be restored. And Nebuchadnezzar already comes to besiege Jerusalem and begin the process of transferring all of the loot. Because he's into money. He's a money grabber, Nebuchadnezzar, right? Power and money. Surprise, surprise. Yeah. That's a very good question, and the suggestion is that it's actually Koresh, the one who we spoke about, who allows...
So it's 130 years?
It seems to be a bit, maybe, it's very hard to put dates on it. We're going to have to deal with the date, all right, when we get to it. There's a big discussion whether it's really Koresh or whether it's Darius. All the names get messed up because they're generic names. A lot of the names, like Paro, it's a generic term. So when you deal with, for instance, Achashverosh, he's going to get a mention here in the Sefer. Which Achashverosh is it, right? It's not the Achashverosh of the Megillah, they say, because he's not, it's before his time, right? Because remember, he's after Koresh, he's after later on. So we're going to get all of this kind of complication in terms of when they use the names, they become generic names, like all the kings and queens seem to do, you know, till this very day. Alright, so with that kind of picture of where we are and what's happening, let's jump into chapter 1. And we'll learn the Perek, and you'll get a feel. Chapter 1, Perek Aleph, is the kind of easing you into it because it's still in Hebrew. In other words, it's in a recognizable language. I'm not going to say very much about the Aramaic that's going to come up from chapter 2 through chapter 6, through chapter 7, essentially, because that Aramaic is... we're going to try and give a suggestion why it was put into Aramaic, why it was actually written in that particular language, and... I once had a lecturer in London who was a grandson of Chaim Weizmann. His name was Michael Weizmann. Very, very interesting man. Very brilliant man who unfortunately died very young man, 50, 51 years old. And he was lecturing in the college where I was studying, this Jews college. Those of you who heard the speech on Saturday night, that was the chief rabbi referred to, Rabbi Sachs. And Michael Weizmann really was an expert on Aramaic. And he would talk about Western dialects and Eastern dialects, and I honestly not quite sure what dialect it was, but I know it's different to Gemara Aramaic. So that's going to be an issue which we're going to deal with. You'll see similarities to Hebrew, similarities to language that you find in Talmud, but the Aramaic of Sefer Daniel is pretty unique in its own right. That's what I'm going to say at the moment, but we're not getting into the Aramaic yet. So listen to this. Aleph, chapter 1, verse 1, and it should be on page 1, I guess, or page 2, whatever. Page 1, there you go, good. B'shnat shalosh l'malchut Yehoyakim, the mem, Melech Yehuda. It's the third year of the kingdom of Yehoyakim, and I'm not going to go into this. You can look in the Rashi, and Rashi will tell you that it's not quite, the chronology is not quite correct from the beginning, but whatever, it's the third year either of his reign or of his rebellion against Nebuchadnezzar. All right, meaning that he's already, Jehoiakim has been on the throne longer than 3 years. But he rebelled against Nebuchadnezzar for 3 years. They already did not give in to the pressure that was coming from Bavel, from Babylon. But at this point of the third year of whatever it is that is happening, Bar Nebuchadnezzar, Melech Bavel, Yerushalayim, Nebuchadnezzar comes to Jerusalem, and he makes a siege. Okay, so he starts a process of conquest. And this is not the Churban Abayim. What's going to happen is that this is just going to be the beginning of the siege of Jerusalem, which takes a number of years before it's finally they enter Jerusalem and they destroy it. So this is a number of years before the actual Churban. And what happened? Bet. Vayitain Hashem biyado, et Yoyakim melech Yehuda. And interesting, the way it's written, right? You know, this is recognizing this was, and Hashem is written Aleph Dalet Nun Yud, which is Adon, you know, the idea of God as the master. This was all from the hand of God. There's no question about it, especially if it was saying this is written, as the Gemara says, by the men of the Great Assembly, Anshei Knesset Gedolah. They're giving a kind of religious perspective on what happened as well. So, Vayitain Hashem biyado, who was given over by God into the hand of Nebuchadnezzar, et Yoyakim melech Yehuda. He was given over already, this king, the king of Judah, was taken away. Umiksat klei beit elohim, and some of the vessels of the temple. So as I said, it took a bit of time, and the siege was on and off for a period of time, but the Babylonians would try and get into the Beit HaMikdash to take out the kelim. Vayivieim eretz Shinar beit elohav, and of course it was brought to the land of Shinar, which is the equivalent of Babylon, Iraq, or wherever his center was, to the house of his God. In other words, Nebuchadnezzar wanted to make an offering to his God. And he brought all these kelim, all of these vessels, into the storehouse of his God. And what we're going to see is very interesting. We're going to learn about Nebuchadnezzar. All right. Again, I always found that a challenging idea of what happened next. Right? We spoke about this with the Megillah. Megillah, what happened in chapter 11 of the Megillah, which doesn't exist? So we explained that chapter 11 is essentially the book of Nehemiah, and we went through that whole explanation. And here, we're going to all of a sudden discover things about Nebuchadnezzar, a name that you know, is almost impossible to pronounce anyway, but assuming that one has heard of him, it's always been a question mark. What happened to the guy? What exactly, in our tradition, came next, right? He destroys the temple, and we sort of check out. We don't seem to find out about him, and Sefer Daniel fills in the gaps, right? I don't know if it's known, but he actually became mad as a dog. I don't know if this is a famous piece of knowledge, but he... And the Gemara talks about it, but it's actually in the Psukim, and we'll see what happened to him. It's an unbelievable story. So listen to this. Gimel. Vayoma melech la'ashpanaz rav sarisa. So he has, they all have a chief officer. In this case, the king, Nebuchadnezzar, had a chief officer called Ashpenaz. All right, that was his name. Lahavi mibnei Yisrael mizera melucha min hapartamim. He wants to bring from the captives, I guess, people already in Bavel, from the children of Israel, from the zera melucha, from the royal seed. Right. In other words, he wants to bring into the palace, I mean, apart from him, from the nobles, he wants to gather together all of these, important people from the captives and bring them into the palace. I guess he thinks that, you know, either to honor him or to honor his God. You see that he's got an ego which is as large as Carnegie Hall, if not bigger. And the reality is that this guy, Nebuchadnezzar, has got plans for these people. And who are they? Dalit. Yiladim asheim behem kol ma'um. These were children, young, in this case, people from Eretz Yisrael, very young children who had no blemish. V'tovei mareh, and they were good of appearance. U'maskilim b'chol chachma, they'd already developed channels of wisdom, right? V'yodei adat m'vnei mada, and they, you know, think about mada and sort of connection to yesterday with YU, Torah Mada. So you see here the use of Mavinei Mada. Look at the translation here. They can express their thoughts, they have strength to stand in the king's palace. In other words, these are of the brightest of these young men who've come to Bavel, captives. I want them to be brought to the palace, says the king. Ulamdam Sefer. He wants to turn them into good Babylonians, right? He'll teach them the language, he'll teach them the writing, the books of the Kazdim, of the Chaldeans, of the Babylonians. That's the plan. And of course, the idea will be that then they will go out and control the populace that is being brought into captivity, and they'll have their own landsman, you know, the guy who can speak the language, he can speak the local language, and obviously he'll be able to speak to the captives, and this is Nebuchadnezzar's plan. What did he do as a result? So, it's such an interesting story. These young men that were brought into the palace, The king would give them every single day mipat bag hamelech. This is a great word, bag. All right, nothing to do with the stuff, I don't know what I'm going to call it, the religiosity at the moment, checking for those things. This is bag. This actually means a portion of food, pat bag hamelech, from the king's portion, right? Umiyein mishtav. So they fed them well. They gave them wine. Ulugadlam shanim shalosh, and they would keep them there for 3 years. It was a whole training program, right, to become more Babylonian than the Babylonians. Umiksatam yamdu lifnei hamelech, and some of them would then be brought to stand before the king. So this was the plan, the idea of building, I suppose, a kind of infrastructure to control the masses that he was bringing to Babylon as captives. Now, here we got the first introduction to Daniel. Vayihi bahem ibn Yehuda, who was amongst them from the sons of Judah, Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, Azariah, the names that we recognize. Now, when you ever hear the gospel tunes, you'll know that they call them by completely different names. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, right? This is the famous gospel tune. So how did these names come about? Look at verse 7. Vayosem lahem sarah sarisim shemot. You've got to make them into good Babylonians. You've got to give them Babylonian names. Remember, we spoke about this with Mordechai and Esther. It's so interesting, right? That Mordechai and Esther were not Jewish names. Marduk and Astarte, these were the names of the gods. So here also, they're being given names which reflect the religion, the society which they're going into. So, Vayosem le Daniel Belshazzar. That was Daniel's name in Babylon. Belshazzar. Alright, what does Belshazzar mean? If I'm not mistaken, Rashi says, Hashem Akums Shel Bava. This is to do with the god of Babylon, Shekaruya Bel. Okay, Bel is the name. We'll have Belshazzar, and we'll have all these derivations of that particular name, Bet Lama. Okay, which is the name of the god of the Babylonians. And what's the other part of the name? Rashi says, Shazzar Shem Lashon Chochma. Lashon Arami. It means wise. So he was made, you know, in other words, Daniel was considered to be very wise, according to their estimation, because of their God. Their God had an influence on Daniel to make him Belshazzar, the wise one of Bel, of the God of the Babylonians. That was his name. What did they call Hananiah? They called him Shadrach. Okay, now again, it's not even explained here, Rashi, what exactly that name is. What is Shadrach? It's also Lichluch. Yeah, it's got probably double meanings over here as well. And Mishael is Meshach. Okay, so these are the Meshach and all these various names that we recognize. Interesting, in the commentary here in the English, he doesn't explain those other names. But my guess is that they're probably in some of the commentaries here. I didn't even check that, but we'll have to see. All right, and finally, and Azariah, the third friend, Aved Nego. Now that name is explained because the Eved obviously is the word that we recognize from Hebrew, a servant of Nego, and sometimes it's written with a bet, and sometimes with a gimel. Here's written with a gimel, and this is brought from Reb Sadia, where he says, Reb Sadia Gaon, who says that this is again the name of a Babylonian god. All right, so Nibo, Nigo, fine. So what we're basically seeing over here is that in order to, how should we say, acclimatize these young men who are considered to be the leadership of the new group of leaders for the foreign community that is coming to Babylon, and these are taken from the Jewish community, you've got to give them good traditional, you know, sort of Johns, and you know, call them all the different good names that you can call them from the world around them, the gods that are in the society. It's very interesting. So of course, what happens in the gospel tunes is that they forget the original title. We don't, right? There's a very famous Gemara about these guys jumping into the fiery furnace. Compares them to the frogs, to the tzvaradim. I have to look that up and bring it to you. Interesting comparison that the Gemara makes between these guys and the makat tzvardeya, which we'll talk about on another occasion. So listen to this. Chet. Vayosem Daniel libo, asher lo yitga'al bepat bag ha mele, ubiyein mishtap. Daniel realizes he's got a problem. And the problem is the food is not kosher. What am I going to do? He says the wine's not kosher, the bread's not kosher, everything they're giving me, and obviously they'll probably want to give him some meat and whatever, because they want to fatten him up, they want to make him, you know, presentable to the society. And he refuses to eat it. He absolutely refuses to have anything to do with the food. Fascinating. Vayivakesh misar sarisim asher lo yit ga'al. He should not become ga'al, the expression in the Hebrew, ga'al nefesh, although it's with an ayin, this is with an aleph, but it's translated in the same way. The idea of somebody should not be defiled by the food. He doesn't want to be defiled, put on, made sullied, I suppose is a good word as well, in English, by this food. He doesn't want to eat treif, period. Okay, he's got a problem. What is he going to do? And of course, Chazal have got a very perplexed, because this seems to reflect issues of yayin, stam yayin, you know, the issue with the non-Jewish wine, and issues with the patakum and all the other things. These are laws which are generally attributed much later in Jewish history, right? The question is when they actually came about, but you can argue here that already, as far as Daniel was concerned, the problems existed. For him, it was compromising on his Jewishness. Yeah. This is Yain Nesser. Yeah, this is wine for idolatrous wine. Yeah, and that had already roots. Yeah, and as far as the bread is concerned, he doesn't want to touch any of it. He doesn't want to have any of the food. Fascinating. All right, so you know what position is he in to refuse? But he's a shtark. You'll see something about Daniel. It's so interesting that, as I said, he's the Novi, but he's not going to go out to the people. It sort of reminds you a bit of Noach, right? What is Noach called in Yiddish? A tzaddik in pelt. Noach was the tzaddik who wrapped himself in a fur coat. So he was holy for himself, but for nobody else. Daniel is not like Noach, because Daniel, although he doesn't go out to the people, this is a man who is incredibly intense, not about himself. He's really about Am Yisrael, but he's within the limitations where he finds himself. It's very difficult to explain. He's sort of a combination here of the kind of limited person that he would be in this circumstance, but someone who stands on his principles. He doesn't in any way compromise when it comes to, nowadays, you know, we all know these problems when we're living in New York, so we're lucky, we have plenty of places to go and eat. When you're faced with a situation in other places, not so straightforward. I read a story, just a very interesting story. I taught in a school in London. The school where Winston Churchill went to school, various other people like that. And there was a group of Jewish boys there. And I became the tutor, the master there for Sunday morning class. And the headmaster said to me, why don't you come for lunch one day and we'll introduce you to the boys. So I thought, you know, lunch sounds a bit ominous. I wasn't quite sure what he was going to provide. I got to the school that day and he said, we're going to eat with the main school, 700 boys. So there's 700 boys who are not Jewish, and there's about a dozen Jews there, and we're sitting on the headmaster's table. It's like something out of the, you know, things that you read in books, because, you know, the table was raised on a platform, and it was quite something. So we got to the table, don't make up this story, it's a real story, and my mouth dropped, because on the table were 12 plates in cellophane, wrapped in cellophane, with the usual binding, you know, that here we call it OU in London, it's called London Based In. It was wrapped, it was all sealed. And the head then told me the following story. He said he had a big problem. Because what he did was, he called up the caterer who caters for Buckingham Palace. Every so often they have, events where rabbis or whatever, Jonathan Sachs has been there a number of times, and they send kosher food. And what happens is that they send a meal to match the meal that's going on at the same time. So what the head said to me, he said that he would have been lynched because they sent a 6-course meal. This was a lunch on a Wednesday. Most of the boys were having, you know, like bread and water over there, and we're having this slap-up meal. He says we would have been killed, but they would have rioted. I mean, he was funny about it, but I think he was right. So what happened was, he said he had to send half of the food back. It was still an incredible meal. It told me one thing. That, you know, when you actually sort of stand on your laurels, as they say, you stand your ground, something happens. And 5 years later, when one of the boys left and went to university, he thanked me for that meal. He said, I still remember, and this was coming from such secular homes. Two of the boys were Rothschilds. Rothschild family in England is now so secular, it's almost so disconnected. But they came to the Jewish class because they knew that, you know, once upon a time they were Jewish. And they still thanked me. One of the boys, one of the Rothschilds, I remember, he thanked me that he remembered that they had this fantastic kosher meal a number of years ago. You know, and I was there, and he sort of remembered the whole thing. You never know what one kosher meal, you know, like you say, one Shabbos, that could have an effect. Even a meal like that, who knows? Who knows what it can do? And I never forget it. And I'm reminded of it when I read this story. You know, Daniel is standing there, and he's saying to the king of the world, literally, your food's not good enough. Look what happens. We'll go back to the story. Tet. Like Yosef, he became someone that they became enamored with. They liked him. He was the chesed of the rachmim. They had felt kindness towards him and mercy towards him. A special young man. So now the captain has got a problem. The problem is the captain of the king has got a problem. What am I going to do? I'm afraid of my master because you know what he's going to do? He's going to blow a fuse in. Yoreani et Adoni HaMelech. I'm afraid of my master, the king. Asher mino et ma'achalchem et mishtechem. He told me exactly what's on the menu. So if I tell him that you're not eating it, he's going to have my head. He's going to chop my head off. Asher lama yired pneichem zoafim. Because he'll come in and he'll see that you haven't eaten anything, and you'll look with long faces. Min hayiladim asher begilchem, comparison to other young people at your age who look so healthy. V'chiyavtem et roshi lamelech, and my head will be removed from my shoulders. You're putting me in danger. You know, obviously the captain over here was someone who was trying to to placate Daniel, and Daniel wasn't having any of it. V'yomer Daniel el ha-meltzar. Right, so Daniel said to the steward, Meltzar Monhi means a waiter. I mean, maybe it's saying, you know, as far as Daniel was concerned, he was like the waiter. He didn't even think twice about it. But you know, I'll do what I do, says Daniel. Daniel Meltzar, Hashemina Saha Sari Sim al Daniel, who had been appointed over Daniel, Hananiah Mishael Vazari, over those gentlemen, because they were all together. Daniel had these three friends with him, and he says, Nasna Davadecha Yamim Asara. I want you to make an experiment, he said. For 10 days, you know what we're going to do? We're going to live on water and zeronim. What is zeronim? Arbis, right? Well, arbis, what you have at the Shalom Zocher, right? Those garbanzos, right? That's for chickpeas. He says, for 10 days, we're just going to eat something like that and you'll see what's going to happen. What's going to happen is that, you know, they're going to be very hungry. No. He says, it's such an interesting story. Come back and check us in 10 days, how we look. And check us in comparison. You'll do a lineup. On one side of the room will be the people eating the king's food, and on the other side will be the guys eating the arbis. What's it going to be? As you see fit, please do with yourselves. In other words, we want to show you that, you know, we're living by faith. We're living by emunah. And Vayishmala Emla Davar said, he actually agreed, which is amazing when you think about it, because what is Daniel, what position is he to negotiate here? It's an incredible story. Vayinasem Yamim Asara, and it was for 10 days. Umiksad Yamim Asara, and at the end, Ktsei here means at the end of the 10 days, Nira Marihem Tov, they looked healthy and bonny, as you would say. Even, yeah, chula for 10 days, but without the potatoes, without the meat. Just the beans, it's unbelievable. Ubriye basar, they actually put on weight. It's so interesting the way it describes it. They became gezunt. Min ha'koli yaladim ochlim, looked much better than all the other young people there at Patbag HaMelech, who were eating all the special food of the king. Fascinating. Vayihi ha'meltzar nosei et patbagam, v'yei mishtehem, so he got the message. Right, this guy, the officer took away the regular food and he took away the wine. Venotelem zeronim, and he gave them these beans. Vayiladim ha'ela arbatam natan lahem Elohim mada v'aska b'chol sevachman. They of course were incredible students, and they understood all the books that they were given, all the wisdom. But Daniel hevin kol chazon v'chalamot, and Daniel had a special gift to interpret dreams. As I said, this is where we get the comparison to Yosef. It's fascinating. Okay, and there's a lot to be said about the kind of parallel stories that are going to emerge over here. Yudche, we're just going to finish the chapter. Ulemiksata yamim asher amar ha-melech laviyam, vayivyeim sa sarisim lifnei Nebuchadnezzar, at a certain period of time, bring them into Nebuchadnezzar, and he's going to obviously sort of, you know, see what's going on. But Yadaber Itam HaMelech, the king spoke with them. Right? In other words, not Yadaber Lahem Itam. I suppose the idea is maybe with keeping a distance. But this was a man who was so full of himself, it's unbelievable. V'lo nimsa mikulam k'daniel Hanani Mishael v'azari. He had a whole bunch of captives, right, that he was feeding it and trying to make them more Babylonian than the Babylonians, as they say. And the ones that stood out was Daniel and his three friends. And they stood before the king. And he gave them a test. Everything that the king asked them, all the questions, Jeopardy, right? How many rounds? Who knows how many rounds they went through? Everything that the king said, why 10 times greater? They found them that they were 10 times more knowledgeable than everybody put together. I suppose, again, the idea of the 10 days, right? You know, there's the number of 10 here. Also, you know, you can sort of link it to the idea of Aseret HaDibrot, that they represent the 10 commandments, the wisdom, the Chochmat HaTorah. I suppose there's a lot of things that you can say about this. And they were considered to be even better, Al Koch Hartumim. And again, this is a word we remember from Mitzrayim, the magicians, right? Ha'ashafim. There's going to be a whole bunch of names over here, different occult things that they did. It's translated here as astrologers, asher b'chol malchuto, in all of the kingdom of Babylon. Vayhi Daniel at shnat achat the Koresh HaMelech. And Daniel was there right to the first year of Koresh. That means that he lived his whole life through the as I said, he's the link. He is the link in the chain from the days of exile at the beginning of the after the Churban HaBayit HaRishon, destruction of the first temple, right through to Koresh, who announces the rebuilding of the second temple. It's fascinating.
In reference to Yosef,
Binyamin is
Bateret
Masas. Oh, Chamesh Yodas, and this is Esser Yodas. So this is 10 times.
Using Yodas is an uncommon.
And the comparison of the language, correct. It's a similar expression over here. Just to go back to the sheet that I gave you, and just say one more thing about Daniel. We can't go through the whole thing here, but I just want to show you this because it really is very special. Just at the beginning on the right-hand side. Final comments. The third line. Oh, sorry. No, from the beginning, where it says character, Ishuto Shel Daniel Ole Mitoch Perkei Sefer. We're going to get to know his character. For who mitgalem behem ki ish hamalo. He is a man of incredible high standing. Chacham, he's wise. Navon, he's understanding. Ma'amin Gadol, he's a great believer in God. Ish Emet, he's a man of truth. Tzadik v'naki, he's too good to be true. It's almost, you know, this is like Mr. Perfect. Tzadik v'naki, he's righteous and he's pure, clean. Chaver Tov, he's a good friend. V'ish Chesed, a man of kindness. Daniel, who ish Shalem, he's the complete person. Asher kuna b'fi malachei shamayim, ish chamudon. That's the expression I want you to take away this evening. The idea of calling someone ish chamudon. The idea chamud in modern Hebrew means charming. You know, you talk about a child being chamud, very charming, very, very cute. Okay, but here chamudot, the idea of chamud means someone who is really special. Chamud in the sense of the man who gained the trust of the greatest men outside Eretz Israel. And as I said, this story is just remarkable. As famous as it is, you're going to be discovering every step of the way revelations here, which you never knew about Daniel, about the society which the Jews populated at the beginning, what Bavel was really like for them. It's quite shocking in so many ways. And yet, by standing on his ground, by standing on his principles, this is a man who creates an incredible Kiddush Hashem. I'm just going to show you at the halfway, two-thirds of the way down, where it says two subjects. The final comment that I want to make. Shnei nosim omdim b'merkazo shel Sefer Daniel. There's two issues at the heart of this book. Number one, Kiddush Hashem al Yidei Adam, that we're here in the world to make a Kiddush Hashem. And it's good to get a reminder, and this is what this book is going to be all about. V'chein giluyo b'meshech ha'historia b'toldotem shel Arba Malchiyot. And of course, the revelation of God, basically what he's saying here, within the history of not just Am Yisrael in Eretz Yisrael, but Am Yisrael outside. As we saw with Megillat Esther, the idea of God's hand at play, even in these, you know, faraway places, these very dark corners of the world. And it's very uplifting. I have to say, you know, the preparation for this has been, it's just overwhelming in a way. Because of the fact that, as I said, it's so well known, and yet so surprising when you actually sort of sit and learn this and go through it, it's not just surprising, it's actually very, very uplifting. It's very special indeed. So Bezrat Hashem, we've got sort of into the book, we learned the first chapter, we've got introduced to the Daniel and his three friends, the three Chaverim, all of whom make an incredible impression, already show that they're prepared to put their life on the line. They weren't going to compromise on their standard of kashrut right at the beginning of the story. And as we go on, as you'll see, the second chapter, the famous story of the dream of Nebuchadnezzar, where already the language more or less goes into Aramaic almost from the beginning. And chapter 3, which of course is the famous the fiery furnace. And you know, we're going to, as you see as we go along, a lot of these stories are so well known, but to go through them shlav like this is just inspirational. I hope I'm sort of trying to get that excitement across, because it is really quite fabulous. Should we be bypassing this safer in schools? You know, Rav Ariel obviously thinks not, and I tend to agree with him. People made excuses not to learn it. Let's learn it, because it is too special. Sorry? Because it's dealing with messianic themes, it's dealing with issues that I think it throws up a lot of questions that people were afraid of. But you know what? It's so fabulous so far. I mean, just to learn chapter 1 of Daniel, just to see where he stood his ground in that circumstance, it's something special. It's a lesson for every Jew. To be continued. Thank you, everyone. Thank you.